last moment.
That last moment comes on August 31st. Thousands, including British troops and eligible Afghans, are yet to be evacuated, and the threat of more attacks is looming. Pressure on the government over its handling of the crisis is mounting.
The Foreign Secretary shouts now, but he stayed on holiday while our mission in Afghanistan was disintegrating. You cannot coordinate an international response from the beach.
It's a shambolic end to a 20-year-long U.S.-led occupation, leaving ordinary Afghans to fend for themselves in a country torn by decades of war.
They invaded on a pretext which was a false pretext, and then for 20 years they've spent $2 to $3 trillion destroying that country. The future in that regard is tough for the Afghani people. They're starting from a very low base as one of the poorest countries on earth, but they're a resourceful, ingenious people who are well capable of lifting themselves out of their current situation.
The UK followed the US and their NATO allies into Afghanistan in 2001, purportedly to topple the Taliban, only to hand the country back to the militant group two decades later.
Imperialism invades for reasons of extraction of material wealth, to dominate markets, to dominate labor, to dominate resources. They had a geostrategic policy to dominate the oil of that region. Forget their talk about green energy. They want to extract the maximum fossil fuels from the Middle East and dominate every government, any government which stands in their way and is non-compliant.
The Kabul airport attacks will probably not be the last ones. A taste of what to expect in post-occupation Afghanistan.
Experts say what's happening in Afghanistan right now is another crisis created by an illegal war waged by the U.S., the U.K., and other NATO countries. Another example that military invasion or intervention is not conducive to stability or lasting peace. Saeed Pariza, London.
Turkey still seems to be undecided over the issue of the Kabul airport. The Turkish president said Ankara is still yet to decide on a request by the Taliban to run the airport. This came in a presser held in Atatürk Airport ahead of a trip the president is taking to Sarajevo. After Turkey's decision to withdraw troops located at the Kabul airport, the Taliban asked Turkey's assistance in operating the airport. Ankara says it isn't against the idea. However, there are certain things that the Taliban should provide first, such as securing the airport, especially after the latest bombing that took place on Thursday.
The Taliban have made a request regarding the operation of Kabul airport. They say we'll ensure security and you can operate it. But we have not made a decision yet because there's always the possibility of death and such things there.
Turkish president said the hesitation is due to several factors. The main one is the current power vacuum, assuring that a decision will be made once a new government is formed and security is prevailed in Afghanistan. He added that commercial flights to Kabul will not be resumed now. Turkey urged the Taliban earlier to form an inclusive government, which includes former Afghan leaders. Ankara said those politicians have a certain credibility internationally and would help in ensuring political stability. Turkey is currently working to evacuate its citizens from Afghanistan. However, it seems that Ankara plans to accept Taliban's offer to run the airport, assuring that it is very important to keep the airport functioning to help receive aid supplies. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
The Italian government is considering further expanding its Green Pass scheme, which is part of a plan that aims to have 80% of its citizens vaccinated against the pandemic by the end of September. Despite a significant recent slowdown in the vaccination rate, about 60% of the population has received both doses of COVID-19 vaccine in Italy so far. The government is now considering making it a requirement for employees to show proof of vaccination, testing or recovery at workplaces, including public offices and supermarkets.
Mind you, the Sicily region, which has the lowest number of vaccinated people, could soon be classified as a high-risk red zone. The vast majority of those in intensive care units these days have not been vaccinated, and the Green Pass scheme serves the purpose of changing their mind.
Italy's Prime Minister Mario Draghi has repeatedly said that the use of the Green Pass scheme is the only alternative to a new lockdown. However, a conspicuous number of Italians are opposing the government's anti-COVID rules that they say infringe on the civil liberties.
Many in Italy are not willing to get vaccinated and are against the mandatory anti-COVID Green Pass. Earlier this month, protests were held in several Italian cities against the introduction of new measures requiring proof of vaccination.
L'essere umano è così, non siamo mai tutti.
That's how people are made. We cannot agree on everything, but the vaccine and the Green Pass is the way to go.
Basta queste scuse.
Enough with excuses. We are not kids. Maybe our authorities should be more severe with those who refuse to get vaccinated.
Since August 6, the Green Pass has been required in order to enter cultural and leisure venues across Italy. From September the 1st, the pass will also be a requirement for all teachers and other school staff. However, the National Association of Head Teachers warned on Wednesday that schools are not equipped to check all the students' vaccine passports. Max Civili, Rome.
Representative of the World Health Organization to the Islamic Republic of Iran, Dr. Jafar Hussain, has visited one of the main vaccination centers in capital Tehran to closely monitor the process of vaccination. In a country where the Delta variant of the coronavirus is killing almost 700 people on a daily basis. During his visit, he learned about different phases of the process, both before and after the vaccination. The WHO representative said that despite sanctions and economic problems, Iran is among countries which has already paid for vaccines from COVAX, but the delivery of the vaccines has been delayed for different reasons.
Iran is a country which has paid already for 16.8 million doses from COVAX, already paid with all the economic sanctions, everything it is facing. The problem is that because of the major outbreaks in other part of the world, like India, like Brazil and other, the vaccine availability globally reduced. What our Director General is recommending to every country head of the state, that it is a whole of society, whole of government approach to control COVID. Not only government can do it, not only WHO can do it, not only other UN, not only private, everybody has to join hand.
The number of outpatients with COVID-19 has decreased by almost 2% this week. We anticipate that the number of hospitalizations will even come down next week.
Iran's death toll from COVID-19 has exceeded 100,000. The rapid rise in COVID-19 cases and deaths in the past weeks has prompted Iranian officials to make utmost efforts to import more vaccines and accelerate the vaccination pace.
According to official reports, almost 10% of the Iranian population have already received two jabs of the COVID-19 vaccines. Experts say the pace is too slow. Accordingly, the new Iranian government has vowed to take all necessary measures to accelerate the vaccination pace and manage the pandemic as soon as possible. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
In its latest saber-rattling against Iran, Israel has said it may have to resort to military action against the Islamic Republic. Israeli Minister of Military Affairs Benny Gantz made the threat, accusing Iran of seeking to build a nuclear weapon. He said military action must be considered as a plan B to prevent Iran from accessing the materials for a nuke. Meanwhile, the chief of the staff of the Israeli military made a similar threat, saying the regime is speeding up its, quote, operational plans against Iran. He also noted that Israel has recently approved a military budget to expand its capabilities against the Islamic Republic. Israel's blatant confessions of its warmongering policies come as it points to recent increases in uranium enrichment as evidence that Iran is racing toward producing a bomb. Israel has been alleging that Iran is trying to build nuclear weapons since the 1980s, but it has failed to produce any evidence to support its claims.
Israeli aggression and attack against the Islamic Republic of Iran will be a matter of the existence of the Zionist entity. They are trying to bother from one time to time by cyber, digital, electronic warfare, but Iran has proven its capability of equality and competition among superpowers in this field.
Iran, on the other hand, has pledged that any aggression against it will be met with a decisive response, regardless of where it comes from.
No one in Iran takes this seriously. The Israeli regime has just ended a major catastrophic loss in its conflict with the Palestinian people. So when the Israelis cannot defeat a Palestinian people who are surrounded in a concentration camp called Gaza, then the Israeli regime is in no position to talk about military confrontation with Iran.
Moreover, Iranian officials have on many occasions stressed that Tehran does not want a war, but that Iran will give a crushing response to aggressors. Israel says it wants to prevent Iran from obtaining nuclear arms, while Tel Aviv remains the only possessor of nuclear weapons in the region. In 2008, former U.S. President Jimmy Carter said Israel holds at least 150 nuclear weapons. It was the first time a U.S. president publicly acknowledged Israel's atomic arsenal.
Suicide bombers set off two blasts in Afghanistan's capital, Kabul, on Thursday. The bombings took place outside Hamid Karzai International Airport as thousands were awaiting evacuations following a Taliban takeover of Kabul. Casualties included Afghan civilians and American forces. The U.S. troops suffered their heaviest casualty toll in a single incident in Afghanistan since 2011. In response, President Joe Biden promised punishment for the perpetrators. Biden, under enormous pressure over his administration's handling of the Afghan crisis, said the airlift would continue.
We will not forgive. We will not forget. We will hunt you down and make you pay. We will not be deterred by terrorists. We will not let them stop our mission. We will continue the evacuation.
More than 100,000 people have been flown out of Afghanistan since the Taliban swept into power on August 15. The Taliban had allowed the U.S.-led forces to conduct the airlift while planning to finalize their own government as soon as the American troops left. U.S. forces are racing to complete their withdrawal from Afghanistan by an August 31 deadline set by President Biden. His administration is facing growing criticism over the situation in Afghanistan and what is seen as a hasty withdrawal after two decades of military presence. Biden, however, says the U.S. has long ago achieved its original rationale for invading Afghanistan in 2001, to root out al-Qaeda militants and prevent a repeat of the September 11 attacks on the United States. Analysts believe the U.S. has failed to achieve any of its objectives.
Despite spending $200 million per day over the past 20 years, accumulating well in excess of some $2-3 trillion of U.S. taxpayer money, despite sending hundreds of thousands of U.S. troops, our youth, our sisters and brothers who are now traumatized, some lost life and limb, U.S. imperialism has very clearly lost. They've been kicked out by an indigenous resistance.
The U.S. invaded Afghanistan with the stated goal of toppling the Taliban and improving security there. 20 years on, nothing has changed on the ground except the death of tens of thousands of innocent civilians. That, along with the current chaotic pullout, has more than ever raised questions on Washington's real intention about this Afghanistan operation.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Come on. It's time to get up. Good morning.
Good morning. Your captain speaking, and we're currently cruising over Iranian skies.
ایستگاه شهید بهشتی مسافرین گرامی خواهشمند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything? Good morning, all.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among thy troops are the victors, and place me in thy party, for thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among thy friends, for thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging. And to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless thou repulsed him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names, in the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is his anger, and I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is his good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from thee, O patron of beneficence.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of internet.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Thousands of Palestinians have been arrested since the beginning of this year. The Israeli regime has swept into many areas, arresting young Palestinians because they are the most active in resisting Israeli occupation. Many of the youths who were arrested have received harsh sentences of 25 years in jail. Some are facing life. Others have not been charged but are still languishing away in jail. This is human rights, Israeli style. We've earlier talked to our correspondent in the occupied West Bank, and she shed some light on Israel's crackdown on Palestinians. Let's take a listen at what she had to say.
We are speaking about 1,900 Palestinians were arrested in Al-Quds, dozens of them. Of course, we are speaking about hundreds of Palestinian minors. Dozens of those 1,900 are under the age of 14. It's against all international laws, according to Palestinian human rights as well as international human rights. So it's an attempt to intimidate them as well as to prevent any Palestinian to be engaged in the different forms of resistance, struggle, or activities against the Israeli occupation. In addition to those arrests, since the beginning of 2021, Palestinian Human Rights said that all over the occupied West Bank, 1,000 Palestinian minors were detained by the Israeli forces. 130 Palestinian women were detained by the Israeli soldiers across the occupied territories. This brings the number of Palestinians who are still languishing in the Israeli jails of over 4,500 Palestinians, because the Israeli forces, the Israeli authorities, use the policy that's known as the revolving door. So at the time they release Palestinians who end their terms in Israeli jails, every day they storm and raid Palestinian areas to continue arresting more Palestinians across the occupied territories.
Well, I'd like to welcome my guests to this spotlight. Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign, Mick Napier out of Edinburgh. And from the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masoud Shajere out of London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, thank you both for being with us here on the Spotlight. Well, let's start this off with Mick. Israel embarks on night raids of villages trying to cause as much fear and confusion as possible for Palestinians. They arrest young adults and many times even children and hold them without even charging them. I mean, what does all of this mean, that nothing is being done against this?
Well, your question contains the answer. The whole point is to instill fear and to terrorize the captive population of the West Bank. There was actually a group of quite prominent Zionist lawyers went to the West Bank a couple of years ago from London, very prestigious, big names, too expensive for me to be able to hire. And they came back absolutely shocked and stunned. And they said, look, this system is not a legal system at all. There's a 99.7% conviction rate. The whole purpose is to instill fear and terror into the Palestinian people, to demoralize and crush them. That is my view, but I'm talking about the views of a group of Zionist high-flying lawyers who went there and came back and could not ignore that truth. The Israelis have a very big toolbox. One is jailing people. And as I say, the system they have is 99.7%. They also jail hundreds of people without trial. I forget the lady's name, but the woman who was ready to give birth in an Israeli prison a couple of days ago, or maybe she's delivered, I don't know. But she was jailed under legislation from the British era, which simply means you can be jailed because the authorities don't like you. They don't need to present evidence. And these 6 month maximum jailings can be rolled over one, two, three, seven, 11 times. And so people live in a lawless situation. It's best to think of it as a situation of complete lawlessness. When a Palestinian approaches an Israeli checkpoint, his or her fate depends entirely upon the mood of an Israeli private or sergeant or whatever, and how that individual feels determines the life chances, the fate of a Palestinian. To have his ID confiscated because the soldier thinks he's impertinent or looks at him in the wrong way, that can wreck his life, can reduce his family from poverty to utter destitution because he loses his job. So the Palestinians live under this regime which is designed to terrorize them into leaving. It's really quite simple at one level, although it's quite sophisticated in its delivery.
Okay. Well, Masoud, the regime in Tel Aviv appears to be getting even more aggressive with an increase in trying to depopulate Palestinian areas and convert them into settler areas. I mean, your take on all of this?
Well, Mick is absolutely right, of the picture. But I think we should stop looking at just this particular clip of what is happening during the last 12 months or last year. This has been going on for the last 70 years, over 70 years. Ethnic cleansing, genocidal act, abuse of individual, creating fear as a tool of controlling masses. It's been going on for a very long time. And we all know that not just those who are in under occupation in Palestine, but indeed even the rest of us in the so-called civilized West, Europe and America and everywhere else, we actually are demonized seen as identified and promoted as a terrorist or anti-Semite just because we support the right of Palestinians to live as a human being. And the fact of the matter is that, we know from our experience to stand up against oppressors, there is a price to pay. But the reality is that if we are not all willing to pay that price, united in collective way, then that price becomes much more. It will end up killing people, pregnant women, children, elderly, their houses being demolished. This is happening day in, day out. And indeed, the rest of us need to stand up. We actually have to sort of make this a priority. We cannot have peace in the region without resolving this illegal, oppressive, occupying, illegal occupation and the colonialism. That has to come an end for the region to start moving away from these violence. These violence by the Israeli Zionist state is not just being done by a small group of people. Systematically, youth, Zionist youth, Israeli youth, are actually taught how to hate and how to conflict damage on ordinary Palestinian and continued ethnic cleansing. Mm-hmm. We need to look at the whole picture. We need to look at what has been going on, not just last year, but for whole 70 years. And the international community has to take responsibility.
Okay.
Unless that's done, we are going to see more of this, and indeed more people are going to be silent. And then the price for the rest of those who are standing against this operation, it will become much more heavy price to pay.
Well, Mick, young Palestinians are giving their lives on an almost daily basis, trying to free their people from this occupation, and still there is not the major international condemnation that should be taking place. I want you to explain that, especially now that Masoud was just talking about the international community and their need basically to step up to the plate.
Let's talk about two international communities. Let's talk about one, our political elites and corporate elites as well, who tend to be in strong support of Israel. But the Israelis also know very clearly that public opinion is swinging against them massively. And I think we should ask why, when Israel attacked the Palestinians just a couple of months ago, when the Al-Aqsa Mosque was under threat, when fascist gangs were roving inside 48 and attacking Palestinians, and when families were being thrown onto the street in East Jerusalem, when the resistance in Gaza came to the support of the Al-Aqsa Mosque and fired barrages of rockets into their own land, their own territory called Palestine, which Israel occupies at the moment, it's quite interesting that Israel did not go as far as they did with Operation Protective Edge or Cast Lead. They stopped after a relatively short period, and I'm sorry to say this, after killing only 100 or so Palestinians. Previously, they had killed 1,000 or 2,000 in these terrible massacres, the periodic massacres that they carry out. Why? I think Israel realized that it was headed for a disaster, that this was a political disaster for Israel, and the deep unpopularity that Israel is in public opinion was getting worse and worse and worse. Look, there are two extra dimensions to this I would add to what Masoud says. One is the political tradition in Israel today, which was represented by Netanyahu and by the other dominant groups now, they don't think that they only deserve Palestine. They think that they also deserve Jordan. Their appetites are not restricted to the Jordan River, and the Palestinians with their blood and the incredible heroism that you've just mentioned, the fact that these young men and young women continue to resist, they are not just defending Palestine, they're defending the peoples of the entire region, because the appetites of the Zionists don't stop at the Jordan River. The other dimension that I would add, if I may, is that one of the reasons it's gone on for so long, certainly the last 4 or 5 decades, is that it makes money, that the Palestinians are not only cruelly abused, they are monetized by the Zionist state, because the weapons, many of the weapons that were used in Afghanistan as part of the spending of $2 trillion, which ultimately was unsuccessful, but many of those weapons were tested on Palestinians and then sold by Israel to the USA. So the occupation can be a moneymaker for the Israelis, and it's also a moneymaker in a slightly lesser way. They charge. The Israelis steal most of the aid which is destined for Palestinians as humanitarian aid. And even if you speak to a Palestinian prisoner, we started off talking about the prisoners, if you're a prisoner in the Israeli dungeons, they feed you pig's fill. But if the families pay money, and it's a fair amount of money for their loved ones in these dungeons, they can be given better food. So, no, anything that resembles international law is violated by the Israelis, and mm-hmm. they even abuse the prisoners, not just in terms of cruel torture, which has been researched and shown by many, many bodies, but even at the level of depriving them of decent food, unless that their families cough up extra money.
Okay.
It's blackmail all round. So mm-hmm. yes, Masoud's right, this is a brutal system that's gone on for many, many decades, but it's got a certain grisly stability because of this money-making aspect to it.
Well, Masoud, what does all of this do to the psyche of young Palestinians, especially growing up with this backdrop day in, day out? Checkpoints, apartheid wall, night raids, demolition of homes, not having access to clean water or little electricity. I mean, what does this do to their psyche day in and day out?
Well, they realize, if they haven't realized before, they realize now that the only one they could rely on is themselves. Palestinians have got no other option than to resist this illegal, brutal occupation, this sort of colonial abuses that is taking place day in, day out. And, you know, it takes place despite whatever the Palestinians do. This is an ethnic cleansing systematically in place. And I just want to add one more thing to what Mick was saying, mm-hmm. and that is that Israel needs to create fear among its own citizens to justify this illegal, brutal occupation and this Zionism. And if there, if you know, so that actually is the need of this state. This state, this illegal state, is in need of conflict. Without conflict, it will not be able to justify its existence. And so, you know, this is going to go on. And Palestinians have got no other option. The real point is what the rest of us are going to do. Are we going to rise up and support the Palestinians? And how far we will go, and do we allow the lobby, the Zionist lobby, what they do in Britain and in United States and elsewhere, what they did with Jeremy Corbyn, what they're doing with the Jewish sort of pro-Palestinians in Labour Party and elsewhere, do we allow that to continue, or do we all unite and stand together? We are doing a good job, and actually I think we need to do more. We need to realize that, as Mick was saying, their days are outnumbered. The fact of the matter is more ordinary people are seeing the brutality of what's going on for what it is, and this sort of empty propaganda that this Zionist state is the only democracy in the region, it really is such a joke, but most people are waking up to the reality that is not the case, and we need to continue this resistance united and creating a better society, a justice society for everyone in the region. And I think that's the way forward.
What about that, Mick? More people are waking up. Your take on that, and is that a sign of actually Israel not no longer being able to totally control the narrative as they have been? And is this a sign of waning power coming out of Tel Aviv?
It's much better than that. Not only are they unable to control the narrative, they've lost the narrative completely. If you and I are having a discussion, a debate, and it becomes pretty heated and it's very serious, and at a certain point in time I say, don't let her speak, it's because I've lost the argument. If I'm winning the argument, I don't need to silence you. I will carry on winning. Israel wants to silence Masoud, myself, everybody who speaks up for Palestine, without exception, and they want to silence these people because they have lost the argument comprehensively. When we started talking about 20 years ago about Israeli apartheid, we were of lone voices. Very few people would agree with us. And some people who were pro-Palestine said, oh, you're going too far. It's bad, but it's not apartheid. The argument is won. We've won the argument in terms of mainstream, decent, enlightened, and also indifferent public opinion. Israel has lost it. To call Israel an apartheid state, nobody raises an eyebrow. Of course it is. Jewish-only roads, two legal systems, one for Jews and one for Palestinians. It's not a discussion any longer. And you can tell this because Human Rights Watch, not a radical body, or the major Israeli human rights organization, B'Tselem, has come out openly to say Israel is a system based on Jewish supremacy from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean. Not just in the West Bank, but everywhere the Israeli foot falls. So yes, they have lost the argument. The question is, how quickly can we turn this into such action that our elites who are currently selling weapons to Israel will be forced to do what they did with South Africa and abandon a regime whose only crime ever in their eyes will be to fail. You see, the South African regime, the corrupt regime that was ruling in Kabul until recently, the only crime they have that's recognized is failure. But once you fail, then you'll be discarded. We need to turn public opinion into, like gas needs a piston to move, to channel it into effective solidarity. But we don't need to fight for public opinion. Israel's lost that already. The fight is to channel it into BDS activity.
What about that, Master? What does it take to expand this fight? Mig said that the argument has already been won. Now it's a matter of convincing the elites to stop supporting, the political elites to stop supporting that apartheid regime, and also increase pressure from civil society. Tell me, what is it going to take?
Everything, really. BDS, we need to boycott everything Israeli and all the companies who are supporting the State of Israel. And they're extremely scared of this. But we need to continue it. We need to actually do it religiously. We need to put pressure on the politicians. The politicians in so-called democracies in the West and Europe and United States are going against the masses. The masses are becoming more pro-Palestinian, while the elite and the companies becoming more pro-Israeli. There are reasons for that. Mick mentioned some of it is economy and everything else. What we need to do, we need to extend our work, and we need to expose every atrocity being committed by this Zionist state, and we need to actually make it as such, like South Africa, that people will be ashamed of supporting and associating with such a regime. When we achieve that, we have actually finally won the whole thing. Not just the argument among the civil society. We have gone all the way, and it will be end of this oppressive regime.
And Mick, do you think that we're getting closer to that day?
Who knows? Nobody knows. Nobody predicted a week before that the Berlin Wall would fall. Nobody could predict when the Shah of Iran would fall. You could say he will fall, but nobody could predict the time. It has never been possible in a struggle against a brutal regime, it has never been possible to predict the hour or even the year of its fall. It will fall because it's unsustainable. The Palestinians will continue to pay a very, very high price. That price can be lowered by the peoples of the Middle East and the peoples around the world coming to the support of the Palestinians.
Okay, and
but
on
it
that
will continue
note,
to be a cruel struggle.
On that note, I thank both of you for being with me. We're out of time. Scottish, from the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign, Mick Napier of Edinburgh, and from Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masoud Shajarin, out of London. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. website is www.parstoday.com/en. From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Today I have come to my grandma's home. I have come here in order to help my grandma in organizing her books and dusting her little bookshelf. This shelf has the collections of poems of great Iranian poets. This is the Divan of Hafez. Oh, how beautiful the miniature is. And it's the Golestan of Saadi. And, this is the collection of Khayyam's quatrains. Oh, it's so dusty. while I dust and sort out the books, get yourself ready for a new tour. Today we are going to visit a big library in Tehran, to the National Library of Iran. The first building of the National Library of Iran was built next to the building of National Museum of Iran. This building was designed by French architect and archaeologist André Godard. The National Library of Iran was officially opened in 1937. Years later, in 1961, a new building was attached to the library. In 2005, the new building of the National Library of Iran was established. The new 8-story building has been constructed in an area of 97,000 square meters. The new building of the National Library of Iran is seismic resistant and is so strong that can even withstand earthquakes measuring 9 on the Richter scale. The National Library of Iran has the capacity to house 4 to 7 million books. I am now in the area of the National Library of Iran. Here is a very green, beautiful environment, and just across from me, there is a big building. It's a brick-made building. This building gives me the kind of sense which buildings with Iranian architecture radiate, a sense of peace and calm. Let's go inside. The National Library of Iran has 9 study halls, each named after an Iranian renowned person. I am now in Khwarazmi Hall, which is very big. This hall has rare and manuscript books. In Khwarazmi Hall, a rich collection of manuscripts and lithographs are kept. I am now in Rudaki Study Hall. This hall is dedicated to people with low vision or blindness. Several people are studying in this hall, and I better not to disturb them. My God, this library is so huge. I don't think I could visit all the study halls. It takes much time. Well, the structure of the National Library of Iran has stair-like and pyramid-like architecture. This architectural characteristic has made it appropriate for the main spaces and study halls to enjoy the natural light. I should bring my grandma to this library. Sure, she will like it. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Good morning!
Iran, IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.